Seattle's Morning News with Dave Ross. Good morning. I'm Colleen O'Brien. As much as we would love a simple assessment of Seattle's minimum wage hike, it's just not that easy. We have to listen to all the science, all the studies, all the research. The University of Washington has been studying the experiment since it began. So we're going to bring in the person heading up that research, Jacob Vigder, a professor of public policy and governance and the director of the Seattle Minimum Wage Study, the Northwest Applied Public Policy Lab. Whew, Jacob, you've got a big and important title.
Well, thank you, Colleen. I'm trying to make it shorter, but the university, you know, they're hard to work with.
Absolutely. We haven't checked in with you since 2017. So what is new with the study? Because you caused some waves with that first dump of research.
That's right. Last year, we came out with this report that said the number of low-wage jobs in Seattle was shrinking. And in fact, the shrinkage was so great that the amount of money paid out to low-wage workers in Seattle's labor market had declined. So that was a big story then. But what we were doing back then is just counting up jobs at different points in time and comparing the number. What we're doing with the new study is we're actually following individual workers over time, about 14,000 of them, to see what happened to them.
And what happened to them? Because you studied three different types of workers, those who were gainfully employed at the time the minimum wage kicked in, those who were working a little bit less with it, and then those who were unemployed and entering the workforce. So what happened with them?
That's right. We start out with about 14,000 people who we observe in our data working the lowest paid jobs in Seattle at the beginning of 2015 before the minimum wage started going up. There's a big distinction between those who had put in more hours on the job and those who had put in less hours on the job. The workers who had put in more hours on the job actually came out ahead, and they saw about $20 a week increase in their pay. They did see their hours go down a little bit, but not enough to sort of circumvent the wage increases. The less experienced workers, they more or less broke even. They did see their hourly wages go up, but their hours were cut back enough that basically they're ending up making about the same amount of money. They're working fewer hours to make that money. So the third group that we're trying to keep track of is people who weren't yet employed by the time the minimum wage goes up. And so what we see in Seattle is that the number of people newly entering the workforce sort of peaked right around the time the minimum wage started increasing, and it's actually declined since then.
So they were priced out of the job market. Am I understanding that correctly?
I'll tell you a story that we're hearing from some employers, which is that when the minimum wage is as high as it is, you're looking at hiring someone with no experience that you're going to have to train on the job. Mm-hmm. And that proposition compared to trying to find an experienced worker who knows the job already, who can start work on day one, that's sort of changing the decision for them. And they are more likely to favor hiring someone with experience if they can find them.
Were they able to ever overcome that pricing out of the job market?
So I think that there's one challenge that we face with our data, which we have data on people who have a job. If someone goes through and they never get a job, we never see them. So it's really hard for us to track what's going on with them. We're trying to put together more different data resources to have a better idea of who really is trying to break into this workforce and who isn't. There's a possibility here, which is that we're seeing fewer people come into the low-wage workforce, not necessarily because there are a lot of people out there looking and not finding work. It's also possible that there are a lot fewer people looking. Because one thing that we know is that it's really expensive to live in this region, and the number of people who are moving to Seattle thinking, you know, I think that I'll rent an apartment there and then just try to find a minimum wage job is probably low.
Yeah, that would be very difficult. So with these mixed results from the last dump of research in which people declared, see, Seattle's minimum wage is hurting people, even though it had good intentions. And now this one where it says, well, actually, it's just a very specific group of people that it's hindering slightly, but we don't know if that's a permanent hindrance. How do you explain those two different outcomes?
Well, I don't think that I would have ever told anybody that I thought that the minimum wage had the same effect on everyone. When we came out with our study last year, we were reporting that the number of jobs seemed to be down about 5%. I mean, the flip side of that story is that 95% of people still had jobs. Mm-hmm. And so the minimum wage is this sort of thing that's going to present these trade-offs that we do see that there's a good number of workers who are coming out ahead, either because they're taking home more money or they're making the same amount of money in fewer hours. But then, you know, there's this other group that we may be a little bit more concerned about. So I think that when we evaluate this policy, we just have to sort of think, are we willing to accept that as it's worth the benefit of putting more money in people's pockets if we have this smaller group of people that may be having a little bit more difficulty finding their first job?
Are you starting to see a pattern emerge in the minimum wage through your research that shows a good outcome in the end?
I'd say, you know, a good outcome. It's really interesting. I've heard from a lot of folks from all over the spectrum who have read the study and have given feedback on it. And it's really a question of values as to whether they consider this outcome to be good. If you know, the further analysis that we're going to do confirms what we're thinking is happening in the data. For some people, the folks that are taking home more money as a consequence of this, they were the people we were trying to help. They were the people who had been in the low-wage workforce for a long time. They're not necessarily upwardly mobile people. They are the people for whom these were dead-end jobs, and we've put more money in their pockets. Some people might look at the teenagers and other young people who are trying to get that first job and maybe having a little bit more difficulty, and they might say to themselves, you know, they're going to be okay in the end because they're going to stay in school, they're going to get certificates and degrees, and they're going to end up in a labor market that's much better than the minimum wage labor market.
What's the next step for your research?
Well, what we're working on right now is linking together more data resources. So we're working with Employment Security Department data now. We're going to merge in more data records so we have an even better picture of who's in this labor market and who's coming out the furthest ahead as a consequence of this policy.
We've been talking with Jacob Vigder, professor of public policy and governance at the University of Washington. He's been studying the Seattle minimum wage since the start. Jacob, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Colleen.
It's time for Choke Points. It's brought to you by Online Training Academy. Chris went up to Everett in a neighborhood back in August to check out speeding complaints and what the city might do to make the area safer. And I'm particularly interested in this, Sully, because I've got some speeders in my neighborhood. What'd you find out?
Well, Steve Schneider contacted me in August complaining that cut-through traffic in his neighborhood was out of control. He told me that drivers routinely drive at dangerous speeds on the downhill 25-mile-an-hour stretch of 3rd Street, which is just east of I-5 in the Lowell neighborhood. He told me, the city actually told me, that it would look into the situation after I kind of alerted them to Steve's situation. And a few weeks later, the city actually gave Steve Schneider a radar gun. To get some real speeding data. So I went back up there and sat in his car for a few hours as he worked the gun.
Ooh, this person might be cooking. There we go, 42, 43, 44.
He hit drivers going over 50 miles an hour on that residential street with his radar gun.
That's reckless. If you're going more than twice the speed limit, you can get ticketed for reckless.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you could count on close to one hand the actual number of people that were going close to the speed limit.
Who's going faster than 10 over? I mean, look at that. We got four people who are going 40, three are going 41, two are going 44, two are going 45, 49, 50, 50. It's like, come on. Like, that's... I can live with 10 over. I can't live with 20 over. That doesn't give anybody a chance, you know?
And, you know, again, this is a residential neighborhood with no sidewalks, a lot of kids as well. Most drivers, when I was there, were going about 10 miles an hour, over 35, 38 miles an hour. And there we had a couple of over 40. Schneider says he's more than willing to gather all this data for the city if it helps makes the city, his neighborhood safer.
They want to, and rightfully so, make all decisions based on data. And being a data guy myself for my job, like, I totally get that. Which is why, you know, he was excited that I was willing to come out here and do this. It doesn't sound like when they offer this to people, a lot of people are willing to sit out here with a radar gun.
So, yeah, I mean, he was more than willing to do that. He turned the speed data over to the city, and then a few weeks later, the city installed those small little speed strips across the road to gather even little more data, you know, those little tiny rubber that go across the road to gather a lot more, you know, more maybe more accurate data as well. There's already a your speed sign is in the neighborhood. Well, I think they do get people to at least be aware and maybe slow things down. But Schneider says it faces the wrong direction. Remember, this is what started that whole thing. Is he thinks it's catching the south of this it alerts southbound drivers, but he believes it's the northbound drivers who are going down that hill, which is the bigger problem. He wants that sign switched around.
And do those Your Speed Is sign, do they gather data as well?
I don't believe so. They just flash what your speed is. And the city has said it's not as opposed to installing one that faces the other direction, even if it's just temporary. And what's nice, though, really, in, out of all of this, is that we were able to get the city and the neighborhood to work together on this issue. So this is kind of an interesting step. We'll see what the data shows, and we'll see what next steps they make. But
what can you do? Can you put speed bumps down a hill?
Yeah, you totally can. But in Everett, they do not believe in using speed humps.
Why?
Because their data shows that in speed hump neighborhoods, people slow down for the speed hump, but then they accelerate faster.
We'll just put
getting
them closer
under the
together.
Next one. Well, but anyway, that's what the city of Everett, they're kind of an outlier. Shoreline believes in speed humps. City of Seattle believes in speed bumps or speed humps. And so it's kind of different by agency.
Is there a difference?
Yeah, the speed bump is the small, real, like the one you go that's smaller. Uh-huh. A speed hump is more that gradual one that's about 7 feet wide
I
or
like
8 feet
bumps.
Long. Yeah, the, not my suspension.
Well, don't speed.
Yeah, exactly. But anyway, so it's interesting. They're working on it, and I like the fact that the city is willing to listen to its constituents.
Will they give anybody a radar gun?
Yeah. Seems like if you all you have to do is approach your public works department, your city department, and go, hey, guys, I'm worried about speed. Can I gather some data for you? See what happens. But Everett seems more than willing to do it.
I can't wait to hear the follow up. Thank you, Sully.
Yeah.
I saw a startling statistic that 80,000 people in America died from the flu last season. And the story went on to say that that was more than the people killed by gun violence or overdoses or car crashes. And that was hard for me to wrap my mind around. So let's bring in Dr. Teresa Girolami, president of the King County Medical Society. Good morning, Teresa.
Good morning.
80,000 just last season. That's the highest number since 1976, according to the CDC. Why was last year so deadly?
Last year, we had a strain of the flu that was particularly deadly and not covered that great by the flu vaccine. So when that happens, the death rate and the death toll go way up.
That's really scary. Who are we talking about here? Are these, you know, the typical immune compromised elderly, children, pregnant, or did people, perfectly healthy people, also die of the flu?
I think the first part you said was correct. It is the elderly, the immunocompromised, the children, the infants, some pregnant women. But again, you're right. Healthy people do die. And that's not the norm. But that did happen last year with that particular strain of the flu.
And the big problem I hear people who are hemming and hawing about getting the flu shot is what you've already said, which is last year's flu shot did not do a good job protecting against the strain that was so deadly. How do you improve the PR around the flu shot when that's the case?
The flu shot is our only form of protection against the flu. So it is better to get the flu shot than none at all. The flu shot is derived every year based on last year's flu or the flus in the past. So it's really just a best guess of what the researchers are predicting could be this year. And generally, it's a pretty darn good coverage, you know, 50 to 60 to 70% coverage. So if you don't do the flu shot, you have a zero protection. So you're best bet is to get the flu shot.
And you hear it all the time. Well, what's the point? Or you hear the myth, I'm going to get the flu from the flu shot. There's so many myths around flu vaccines and vaccines in general. What are your thoughts on the anti-vaccination movement?
The flu shot is relatively one of the safest vaccines you can get. There are hardly any downsides to it. Once in a while, somebody might have an egg allergy, and then you might be a little careful, but unless you have like a life-threatening allergy, you really probably can get the shot anyway. You are not going to get the flu from the flu shot. It is a killed virus. It does take about 2 weeks for you to get antibodies. So if you unfortunately were getting sick anyway in that 2 weeks, some people mistakenly think the flu shot gave them the flu, but really you were already sick from something else and it's probably not the flu.
And it's about herd immunity, too. I think, you know, and I'll just say I support vaccines. My child is fully vaccinated. I got the flu shot this year. So did my whole family. And, you know, you hear people say, well, I'm going to get the flu anyway, or the flu shot isn't effective, so I'm just going to skip it. But it's not about you. It's about herd immunity.
Exactly.
So can you explain that?
Yes. So you don't want to go to school and have your child in the classroom with the half of a classroom unvaccinated from the flu. If all that classroom was vaccinated, it would be very difficult for anybody to get the flu in that classroom. So it is for the benefit of the people around you as well to get a flu shot. And that's what they mean by herd immunity. The vaccine can't really work through the crowd if everybody's vaccinated and has antibodies. It's very difficult.
And it's not just the flu vaccine. It is measles, mumps, rubella. It is pertussis. It is varicella. It is polio. It is, you know, these once eradicated diseases now making a comeback. We see measles every year grow. So talk to me about the anti-vaxxer movement, specifically in our communities, and what that's doing.
I am a fan of vaccines. I have three children. My whole family's vaccinated. When people come in my office at Bell Red Internal Medicine, I am not one to sign off waivers for no vaccines, because that is not in the best interest of our community. We don't want to see resurgence of all of these diseases, and we've been excellent in this country about eradicating them. You're right, very few incidences. So people really all should think hard about vaccines, of the good they do. The benefit far outweighs the risks.
How do we have a conversation with somebody, a friend, a family member, who is anti-vaccination for whatever reason?
I would just bring it up. I would say, you know, I don't want my child in a classroom with people that aren't vaccinated, carrying diseases to school. You know, the schools require the forms to be filled out, and it is very difficult, really, to get a waiver not to do it. The colleges actually don't allow it at all. You must show proof of MMR, actually, to go to the University of Washington, for instance. I fill out those forms every day. I think you just have to say, you want your child to have polio or measles, mumps, rubella? Those things killed people. Those cause death. And I think people don't understand that that's why we do it. We don't want to die. And that is the point of getting vaccinated.
Right. A lot of these diseases have been gone for so long now, we forget how horrible they are.
Yeah, I was just reading an article 100 years ago, 1918. We had the worst flu pandemic in the history of the world. 50 to 100 million people died from the flu. The flu. People think it's not a big deal, but it is. It wiped out. That was, at that time, was 3 to 5% of the world's population. So we don't ever want to go back to those days. And people should read history. There are really some very scary things that we have eradicated that people have forgot about.
And doctor, I imagine it's not too late to get the flu shot now.
Get your flu shot all the way up until February. I mean, you need some kind of protection. It's better to have the flu shot than have nothing at all.
That is Dr. Teresa Girolami, president of the King County Medical Society, talking to us about flu season and vaccinations. Thank you, doctor.
Thank you, Colleen.
And it's really easy to get a flu shot, too.
Yeah, and if you think it's the elderly, the young, the infirmed, you're wrong. We have a close friend, a kid at my son's high school, athlete, strapping, nearly died last year of the flu, freshman in high school.
Yeah.
No underlying problems whatsoever. He was in ICU over Christmas for 10 days.
When you see it firsthand, that's when you change your
mind
about.
Lost like 50 pounds and
danger.
Really, and we thought he was going to die.
Yeah.
Here's a kid, just a strap, football, basketball, you name it, stud kid. And, it's real.
Yeah, it's getting scary. I mean, we get the updates from the state health department about the measles and pertussis every year. It just seems those numbers continue to grow. So if you do still have questions about vaccinations, go talk to a doctor. Get the facts. I think Frontline just did a big piece on vaccinations and the myths and the things that parents do believe about vaccinations that are absolutely not true and proven by science to not be true. So maybe watch that Frontline documentary or go talk to a doctor, because you're protecting everyone around you, not just yourself, when you do that. Time for our Sports Insider from 710 ESPN Seattle. It's brought to you by Western Washington Toyota Dealers. And our Sports Insider, of course, Danny O'Neill, weekdays at 3 on Danny, Dave, and Moore. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. I'm feeling great on this Tuesday. How about you?
I'm feeling okay. We're ready to get back to work. Seahawks have returned.
Yeah. There's
everyone's on the uptick here in the state in college football. It's going to be an exciting fall.
Yeah. Tell me about the Seahawks now. They're back at practice. Coach Pete Carroll had a press conference yesterday. What's the injury update, or what's the big story?
Sounds like most of the guys are coming back. KJ Wright, who hasn't played yet this year, coming back from knee surgery, he practiced. Ed Dixon, who hasn't even been active yet this year. He hasn't practiced so much. That was his first practice. He looks good. He had a groin injury.
Why hasn't he practiced?
He had a groin injury. Showed up, and they put him on the non-football injury
list. Those are tough. I never realized how much you use your groin for walking and sitting and standing until I pulled it on one of those machines at the gym, you know, where your legs are open, and then you squeeze them shut with the weights. Pulled both my groins. Yikes.
Yeah.
Or maybe there's only one groin muscle and you pull both sides. I don't know.
But I have heard people say pulled my groins before, okay. Which I always laugh.
That's what I did.
Yes.
And it is surprisingly painful.
Yes.
So I can relate to this pro footballer.
Yes, that's right. Ed Dixon. But he's back. He's ready to go. Nick Vinette, who missed a game because of back injury. Rasheem Green. They're all healthy. They're all cleared to go. We just don't know about the Wolf of Wall Street yet.
Who's that?
Michael Kendricks. The guy that got in trouble for the insider trading.
That's
he had a
right.
hearing yesterday in the NFL league offices. He's been suspended indefinitely. I'm hoping they make him active again.
Why?
Because I don't care about insider trading.
You don't care about this? Okay.
Yeah, it doesn't give me much pause of like, he's going to have to serve his punishment. And it's not that I think that, oh my gosh, it's not a big deal at all. I just don't think he should have to miss work because of it.
He's among the ranks of the hardened criminals like Martha Stewart now.
I know. But that's the thing is like, he's been suspended two games. Jameis Winston, quarterback for Tampa Bay, he groped an Uber driver while he was hammered. And he was suspended three games. And to me, the insider trading guy, that's significantly less, like, that bothers
egregious.
Me a lot less than an unprovoked groping.
So the punishments aren't matching up.
I don't think so.
I'm not surprised.
Does it bother you that he's an insider trader?
Is it a
moral failing on my part that I'm like, he shouldn't do it, and I don't have a problem with him going to jail for it, but in the meantime, let's play some football.
Who did he hurt?
What? Well, you can make the argument that in the long run, it hurts everyone, and it hurts confidence in the market, and there's an opportunity cost. But he didn't steal from someone directly. Mm. He didn't embezzle. He didn't take someone's money like Bernie Madoff.
He just
anything.
Got a good tip, and he went for it.
Yeah, tip might be an overly rosy characterization of getting information on four transactions where
Fair
it was
enough.
After a merger. But anyway, I've been told that I'm soulless and amoral because
really?
I want him to play football. But yeah, let's go. Let's get Michael Kendricks back out there.
Well, that's 2018 for you. You say one thing that's unpopular and suddenly you're the devil. So I'm not surprised people called you out for that.
Yeah.
You be you, Danny.
Okay, I will.
I hear the Seahawks also picked up a new linebacker.
Yeah, they did.
Did you need it?
Yeah, not really. We'll see how that pans out.
Okay.
But I'm not super concerned about that or thinking that, hey, this will change everything. Because hopefully we're going to get the Wolf of Wall Street back.
Yes, hopefully. The World Series getting underway tonight. I have no skin in any of these
sure
games.
Do.
The Boston Red Sox.
Sure
lost. Should I go for the Dodgers because that's
yes.
the West Coast? Okay.
No, it has nothing to do with the West Coast. Oh. You should be against Boston.
I see. Yes, I hear there's a lot of hate for Boston. Sully was rolling his eyes.
I wouldn't say hate, but I don't want them to win another
They're
World
spoiled.
Series.
Where does that come from?
They're spoiled because
we hated the Yankees and we could all agree on that.
That's correct.
You can hate more than one team.
Yes.
You just can't love more than one team according to Danny's rules.
That's correct.
I got it.
Yeah, you can have, you should have, every morning you should wake up and you should know the pantheon of evil. Now, you can debate whether or not Boston or New York, the Yankees or the Red Sox is the worst. Like, there's room for that argument. Now, I firmly think it's the Yankees that
okay.
are the worst fan base.
Fair enough.
Primarily because they've had so much success over such a long period of time, and they've got
like
a level of
down.
Entitlement.
Yeah.
But Boston, that city has a martyr complex, and this dates back a long time. I think it's related to the fact that Philadelphia, New York, and Boston are three brothers.
Mm-hmm.
New York is the incredibly wealthy investment banker. Philadelphia is a really, really tough drywall hanger. They do like really difficult blue collar
type stuff.
Type worth. And Boston is the overeducated smug brother who resents New York because New York makes more money than him and resents Philadelphia because he knows Philadelphia can beat the tar out of him.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just the background of Boston. They went 86 years without winning a World Series, and they wouldn't let us stop hearing about it. Oh, we've never won the World Series. Oh, the curse of the Bambino. And now they won't stop winning. They just keep winning.
Well,
the curse is broken.
They waited for their time.
And it's not just them who've won four World Series. It's also the Patriots who have five World Championships. And the Celtics, they've had some sort of inexplicable rebirth where they not only won one title with Ray Allen, Kevin Garnett, and Paul Pierce, but now they're good again. Enough!
So
they've had too much.
The Bruins also won a Stanley Cup.
It's awful. I was there when they won it.
Within the last 12
years. Yeah, in Vancouver. They made our friendly Canadians up to the north riot. They were so mad.
So we're tired of them winning, therefore we go for the Dodgers.
Yes, that's correct.
All right.
A little bit of socialism, even it out.
So I'm supposed to hate New York, Boston, and Philly. Any others?
Philly's not that hateable.
Okay.
Philly's a tough crowd, but they don't win so much as to be hateable. Hate the Notre Dame fans.
Okay. Oh, you're killing me, dude. Come on.
I know. You've got them on two fronts, Oregon and Notre Dame.
Yeah. I was once a Notre Dame fan, and then I recovered.
Well, as a graduate, you never recover.
That's true.
Got it. Thank you, Danny.
You bet. Talk to you soon.
We'll talk to you tomorrow. Your Sports Insider brought to you by Western Washington Toyota Dealers. I think I have all of that straight.
You got so many rules. Some of the ND Subway alums are pretty awful. I'll have to give Danny that.
Seattle's soda tax is bringing in a lot more money than expected. Millions more than expected. The mayor has a plan for the extra dollars, but the city council not ready to sign off on that plan. So Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott is here to explain all of this to us, Hannah.
All right. So Colleen, the sugary beverage or soda tax was expected to bring in about $15 million in its first year, but that's now expected to be more like $21 million. The mayor's proposed budget uses that extra money for healthy food and education programs that up until now had been paid for through the general fund. Now, that allows the mayor to use that freed up general fund money to balance her overall budget, which increases spending on homelessness, police, and other priorities like transportation. But some on the council are upset with the mayor's proposal, including Deborah Juarez, who says she's really disappointed programs actually included in the soda tax legislation are not getting any of this extra money from the tax.
I'm just going to say it. It's like a switch and bait. You said, please pass this tax for poor people so we can worry about obesity and actually have a place where people can have food because we have food banks and other programs like Fresh Bucks. Oh, but by the way, we had an increase, but we're not going to raise money in the programs that we originally intended this money for.
She specifically is concerned that food banks aren't getting any more of this extra money. Councilmember Mike O'Brien has some similar concerns. He pointed out that the council knew this soda tax would hit the poorest communities hardest, but passed it anyway because the money was going to be used for healthy food and education programs to benefit those communities. And while that is still true of the expected dollars coming in from the tax, O'Brien says it should be also true of the excess money coming in.
It's really important that we're not using a tax on these low-income communities to fund broader societal needs that are good things to do. If we need to do that, we should be coming up with a more equitable tax. But instead, the specific revenue that we're dedicating from here should be going back into those communities as directed.
Now, the mayor's office says her proposed budget focuses on essential services, such as the affordability crisis, expanding transit, and also does continue to continue and expand funding for healthy food access and educational readiness for children and high school grads, which are in line with the intended uses of the soda tax money.
I know the jury's still out, or at least the studies are still out, on consumption rates. So is there any indication that perhaps the city undershot the estimated amount that was going to come in from this tax, knowing it would be more, maybe going,
I don't know that anybody knew that going in. There was supposed to be originally a report with UW report and King County Public Health combined report that came out yesterday was going to be presented to council.
Because that's a big
difference.
With
that, as to is this doing what it was supposed to do? Is it lowering consumption rates among those poorer communities and things of that nature, and as well as other things that they're trying to look for? Now, the fact that that's still a big question mark because that report was delayed. Yeah. It's supposed to come sometime here in the next couple of months at some point. But at any rate, we don't know that answer yet, but the fact that in the first 6 months of the year, it brought in $10 million,
right,
way over expected, suggests maybe it's not doing what it was supposed to do.
It's not cutting down on consumption.
Yeah, and
right,
that's a problem. That was the big selling point on that. And then also to put this money back in the community. So that's something that's going to have to be hammered out as they go through this budget process. The Seattle Times says the council is expected to pass this budget, but with changes. Mm. The mayor's office says she hasn't had any specific changes or recommendations to how to use the money, the extra money from the soda tax yet from the council. So I think that might be something we see coming.
Still to be worked out. And I know there's a state initiative on the November 6th ballot having to do with blocking other cities from enacting a sugar tax similar to what Seattle did.
That is I-1634. And what that would do, it would not rescind or repeal Seattle's sugary beverage tax, but it would keep it from going any higher. Right now, it's 1.75 cents an ounce. So Seattle's would stay the same. No other city or county in the state would be allowed to have one, though.
Any polls out on how that's doing?
And I think the polls are fairly even on that one, is from what I've seen so far. I haven't looked at the latest ones, but so far.
Thank you, Hannah. It's Seattle's Morning News with Dave Ross. Good morning to you on Tuesday. I'm Colleen O'Brien. It's time for our weekly chat with Pulitzer Prize winning reporter David Farenthold from The Washington Post. Good morning, David.
Morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. It's been a while since we've been able to chat with each other. I want to start with some fact-checking on claims the president has been making at rallies, on Twitters, to the press. There's a lot of half-truths or just downright lies as people fact-check. So what stands out to you as the most egregious lie that's coming up these days?
One really interesting thing he's doing, which is a complete falsehood, is that he's telling, and it's, but it's, I think it's a revealing falsehood, he's telling people at his rallies that the Republicans next week are going to pass a new tax bill that's going to give middle class people new tax relief. That's a sign, obviously, that the big tax bill the Republicans passed last year, which gave such big benefits to business and the rich, that hasn't produced the kind of popularity that Trump wanted. And so he said, no, we're going to do this tax bill that's going to help people like you. The problem is Congress is out. They're not going to return to session until after the election. They're out campaigning. So it's not going to happen next week. And the bill he's referring to just doesn't exist. So that's something where he's just made up a bill in the hopes of addressing this thing that that voters obviously are not happy with.
Do you think anybody believes it?
I don't think anyone really believes that. I mean, maybe the people who believe it are the ones who are at his rallies who would believe anything that he says. But I don't think it's, you know, there's no messaging behind it besides him just saying it at rallies. So I don't think it's really reached people in a meaningful way. The maybe more impactful falsehoods are about this migrant caravan that's going from Central America through Mexico. It's still about 1,000 miles from the U.S. border. And Trump is saying that it's full of Middle Easterners, it's full of gang members. We and a lot of other outlets have people traveling with that group of migrants, and it's children, it's women, it's men who've been deported from the U.S. You know, it's what it was described in our paper today as kind of like a small town that was uprooted, including all the women and children and old people. It's not a bunch of Middle Eastern terrorists.
Right. There are many reporters embedded with that group. And, you know, that's the importance of having reporters in journalism, is to get them there on the ground, observing, interviewing, and talking about the truth of what's happening in that situation. The president is hyper-focused on these migrants making their way to the U.S. border with Mexico. What are the current options the president has to stop them?
Well, I think we have to sort of take into account the fact that it's probable that they won't reach the U.S. border like that. In the past, there's been a couple of other migrant caravans that have come before, and they've often stopped in Mexico City, which is still pretty far from the U.S. border, because the logistics of traveling from there north are a lot more complicated, and they often apply for asylum from Mexico City, either in Mexico or apply for asylum in the U.S. at the U.S. embassy there. So I think it's unlikely that we'll see this same kind of long train of people arrive at the U.S. border altogether. If they do, sort of the legal option is to have the Border Patrol, have the Customs and Immigration Enforcement take them into custody there. If they want to apply for asylum, that's what you're allowed to do. And, you know, we'll keep them in custody until their asylum cases are heard. Trump has talked about sending the military, which is, you know, we haven't really done that since the days of Pancho Villa and the Mexican Revolution, having the U.S. military sort of, you know, fighting a battle on the U.S. border with Mexico. The Pentagon has said that they haven't actually gotten any instructions for that. You know, there's obviously a few National Guard soldiers on the border as it is, but in terms of a U.S. military deployment to the border, that doesn't actually seem to be in the works. I think it would be really a bad idea morally and politically to have the U.S. military confronting this group that, as I said, is largely made up of laborers, women, children, families.
Well, and speaking of those children, any word on if there's going to be more family separation? I know he rescinded that policy, but left the door open to reinstate it. With that many people coming along with children, and let's not forget, there are still children in those detention facilities from the last time this flared up. Parents still looking That's for right. their children who were given over to foster care systems and child homes. And here we have more children coming our way. Any word on if that is also going to happen? Are we going to take custody of these children?
Other outlets have reported that the Trump is, and his advisor Stephen Miller are considering reinstating the family separation policy, despite what an enormous, and setting aside the moral dimensions of it, is a bureaucratic matter. It was an enormous mistake for the U.S. We were not prepared in any way. You know, the system we had set up was not ready to handle children separated from their parents, and or to handle the task of reuniting them with their parents. It was a monumental effort to reunite, you know, hundreds of the children that we had, and many of them, as you said, are still separated. I don't think that's what will happen, but it's possible. Certainly Trump seems to be reconsidering it. Honestly, I think, you know, probably these folks are going to arrive at the border after the midterms, which are just in a couple of weeks. I think it may depend on what happens in the midterms, you know, and how Trump is reacting to that.
Sure. David, I want to talk about your latest write-up in the Washington Post. You, of course, you made a name for yourself following the money when it comes to President Trump. Has the presidency been good for his bottom line because his name keeps getting taken off of buildings?
Well, you're probably referring to this thing that happened last week where a Manhattan condo board, this building has been called Trump Place for a long time. They had sued the Trump Organization for the right to take the name down and won. And then last week they did take the name down. That doesn't mean anything to the Trump's bottom line right away. That building is still paying Trump's company to manage it. But it's, you know, the Trump people see this as a slippery slope. If people start taking the name down without legal consequence from Trump Org, then other people may see, you know, if you were in Chicago or you're in New York, you know, in a liberal city where people don't like Trump, what's the upside to keeping Trump's name? We don't really know. In the, you asked about, you know, is the presidency good for the president's business? We don't really know. We've seen instances where Trump's name has come down, where he's lost hotels because his name, he's unpopular. But we don't really know what's going on behind the scenes. And there's a lot of ways that Trump could be making money off U.S. allies, U.S. alliances that we wouldn't see.
I could probably guess, but did the building or the tenants inside the building say why they wanted to remove the name?
Well, they had a vote and voted 69% to take it down. In talking to people at the building, they feel like it's depressing their property values, which that's backed up by data. Some publications that study New York City real estate say that Trump-branded buildings, even in Manhattan's hot condo market, command less of a premium than other buildings that are just like them. You know, you're basically, you know, if you're an owner there, you're giving people a discount to buy into a Trump building. And also people just don't like Trump and then like walking by his name every day.
And David, I don't want to let you go without talking about Jamal Khashoggi, who was a Washington Post contributor. What do you know about the investigation into his, are we still saying apparent murder, or are we just calling it his death?
His death. I think that there's no doubt about that now. The Turks, who apparently had bugged the Saudi consulate and knew everything that was going on there, have been sort of slowly letting details drip out about this. They're not obviously a 100% trustworthy source either. That's a police state that has its, you know, has foreign policy goals at odds with Saudi Arabia. But all signs, including the Saudi government's official statements, now point to Mr. Khashoggi being dead. We don't know exactly how he died, but it seems like he died in the Saudi consulate at the hands of people who work for the Saudi government. And I think it took the Saudi government a long time to admit that, but it seems like that's where they are now.
And it sounds like it's taking the Trump administration even longer to admit it.
Yes, that's right. Even now, the Trump administration, President Trump particularly, has kind of gone back and forth about, you know, is this a big deal? You know, how certain is he that the Saudis are telling the truth about it? It seems like he has been extremely unwilling along the way to cast any doubt on the official Saudi story, even as the official Saudi story changed a number of times. Every time it changed, Trump was 100% behind the latest version of it.
All right. David Farenthold, we talk to him every Tuesday here on Seattle's Morning News at this time. David, thanks for your time.
Thank you.